From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Leaders from seven of the world's largest economies are meeting today in Quebec for the annual G7 summit. President Trump, already at odds with his counterparts, drew another wave of criticism after he called for the G7 to reinstate Russia, which was expelled in 2014 for annexing Crimea. Here was the president this morning.
Whether you like it or not, and it may not be politically correct, but we have a world to run. And in the G7, which used to be the G8, they threw Russia out. They should let Russia come back in.
This comes on top of already tense exchanges over U.S.-imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum. Joining us now is Evan Dyer, senior reporter for the CBC. He's at the summit. Evan, welcome back.
Thanks very much.
And what are other leaders there saying about these Russia comments?
Well, the one who reacted, first of all, was in favor. It was the new prime minister of Italy, Giuseppe Conte. He's only been in office for a week. He's a populist. Giuseppe Conte's maiden speech in parliament actually called for the lifting of sanctions on Russia. So it's not entirely surprising that he would take that line. Other than that, we've had some reaction from Canada. Canada is saying no way. They don't want Russia back in the G7 until Russia ends its annexation of Crimea. We heard the same from the European Commission. Perhaps the leader who would find this most difficult would be Theresa May, because I know that she was speaking to her own media on the way over in the plane and told them that one of her main agenda items for this summit was to get some solidarity, to get other countries on board in a kind of a united front against Russia. Of course, she said the same thing following that alleged nerve gas attack on a former Russian spy, and she called on other NATO members to support her. So not only is President Trump not meeting with her here, which is a bit of a snub already, but he's calling for Vladimir Putin to be here as well.
Well, and even before these Russia comments, he was at odds with the other members of the G7. And the French president, Emmanuel Macron, went after the U.S., writing, "The American president may not mind being isolated, but neither do we mind signing a six-country agreement if need be." How are these tariffs going to be addressed today? Because that was the initial fight.
Yeah, we expect those to come up a little bit later on today in a group session. They'll come up in some of the bilaterals, I'm sure, as well. The only two bilaterals President Trump is having are with Prime Minister Trudeau of Canada and Emmanuel Macron, and both of them are pretty much on the same page about the tariffs. I think Macron may have been overreaching when he claimed to speak for all six countries, because I think we saw yesterday when Shinzo Abe of Japan was in Washington, he's a lot more concerned about North Korea than he is about the tariffs. And I don't think he would necessarily want to alienate President Trump over this issue. But I think if they could unite behind a gentle message that the rest of the world would like to see the U.S. abide by a rules-based system of trade and drop the tariffs, then I think that you could get all six members to sign on. No indication, though, that President Trump wants to hear that message.
Well, and speaking of gentle, it sounded like a gentler tone from Justin Trudeau, the Canadian prime minister, who had called the steel and aluminum tariffs insulting and unacceptable, but yesterday was a bit more diplomatic. Here he is.
There are questions about what is going to be the dynamic at around the G7 table, and I can say that it'll be very similar to other G7 tables, in which we highlight and discuss many things we're agreed on and have differences of opinion on other things. There's no.
How forceful do you expect leaders to be with President Trump?
Well, I think in private they're going to be about as forceful as things ever get at these summits. You know, Justin Trudeau has been relentlessly sunny with Donald Trump. He's a real believer, and we see this in domestic politics too, that you catch more flies with honey. So that's been his approach to Donald Trump. There's not much point in you know, becoming a target, although that does increasingly seem to be happening. Canada does seem to be a bit of a target, reading Donald Trump's tweets over the last 24 hours. But you know, at the same time, the message from Canada has been, if you continue with this and if you retaliate to our retaliatory tariffs, then we will hit right back, because, you know, Prime Minister Trudeau is getting a lot of support domestically for his position all across the country in all regions and from supporters of all parties. And that's not usual in Canada. And we've even seen some polling data that suggests that a majority of Canadians are personally considering boycotting some U.S. goods, which is just unheard of in Canada. It takes a lot to get Canadians irate at the United States, you know, because of all the ties of family, a lot of dual citizens, people with family members, people who've lived in the U.S. And it's not just because of the tariffs. It's because of the pretext behind the tariffs, the national security pretext. That's where they go from being just economically harmful to actually being insulting.
We know that President Trump is going to be leaving the summit early to head to Singapore for his meeting with the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. What will the G7 summit be without the U.S. there?
Well, the topics that he's going to miss by leaving early are not topics that he sees eye to eye with the other leaders on anyway. So he'll miss the session on environment, climate change, cleaning up the oceans, removing plastic from the oceans. These are not things that Donald Trump has spent a lot of time on anyway. And if you think back to the G7 last year in Italy, he wouldn't sign onto the joint communique on climate change. And he went back to Washington, and 3 days later, he pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Accord. Right.
That's Evan Dyer, a senior reporter for the CBC, joining us from Quebec, the site of the Group of Seven summit today. Evan, thank you.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
So G7 leaders have been sparring on Twitter, but social media has also been swamped today by other breaking stories. Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, takes a look at, with us most Fridays. She's here now. And Femi, the death of Anthony Bourdain, of what French authorities say was suicide. You know, and he just seemed to chew on life as well as food. And on Instagram, you've got chefs like David Chang posting black boxes. What are you seeing?
Basically, this is his memorial on social media, his achievements, his impact, what he meant to people. Any social platform you intend to be on today, you are going to see a lot of Anthony Bourdain. Let me give you an idea of the numbers who are looking out for him. The global hashtag this morning, the biggest global hashtag, was his name. Google Trends, which is where people go to look to see how many people are looking up topics online on Google. 5 million plus people were looking up stories about Anthony Bourdain, the most looked up topic so far this morning. And on Instagram, over 130,000 posts, all with Anthony Bourdain pictures from when he was a very young man to quite recently.
Yeah, well, we're going to be hearing much more about that here and during the day. But we want to ask you, last week we talked with you about Philadelphia 76ers president of basketball operations, Brian Colangelo, accused of using fake Twitter accounts to criticize his own team. He's resigned. But it turns out after an investigation, those accounts weren't set up by him, but his wife. What else have we learned?
Well, this was an investigation set up by the NBA. They said, we are going to look into these accusations, and they did. And what they found was, or what the investigators found, was that these Twitter accounts, not fake Twitter accounts, really burner accounts, ones under anonymous names, so you didn't really know who was really running the accounts, linked back to Barbara Pattini. So that's Brian Colangelo's wife. Mm. They used forensic analysis. What did that mean? Well, basically, they took her phone. They looked at her phone and they corroborated that that was her phone that had set up the accounts. And they asked her. And under interview conditions, she said, yes, it was me. Mm-hmm. Now, what the investigators weren't able to find was a direct link back to Brian Colangelo, other than his wife. He said, I did not know about this. The investigators said, I cannot say that, yes, he did. But what we do know is that we highly suspect that the information that Barbara Pattini was using actually came from her husband.
Well, you know, he says that, let's see, there was evidence that he used information from outside the 76ers organization. He says, I had no knowledge or any activity. At no point did I purposely or directly share any information. But note to self, do not be setting up fake accounts. They will find you. Okay, something to, you know, really lift our hearts. The Washington Capitals Stanley Cup 4-3 win last night over the Las Vegas Golden Knights. So sorry, Las Vegas. It got pretty emotional. There was that tearful tribute that player T.J. Oshie made to his father, who has Alzheimer's. Let's listen.
He doesn't remember a lot of stuff these days. He remembers enough, but I tell you what, he's here tonight. I don't know where he's at, but this one will stick with him forever. You can guarantee that.
And then he found his father on the ice and gave him a huge hug. Ay, 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 this flew out.
Oh, yes. Goodness me. Even if you weren't an all-caps fan, you cannot be hardened to this moment. Giovanna tweeted out, do you even have a soul if that interview didn't make you cry? Congrats, TJ. I'm sure your dad is very, very proud of you for many reasons tonight. A lot of grown men were leaking a little liquid from their eyes, perhaps, maybe. Tweets Bradley, I'm not crying, I promise. Mm-hmm. And Chris tweets, oh, man, this cheap just chokes me up.
Okay, so there's that. Go see it. It'll give you a heart.
It's a beautiful moment. Yeah.
But we just have to touch on, we got a minute. Miss America scrapping its swimsuit competition. Mm. Some former contestants praising it, saying it just objectified them. Others saying it made them, you know, want to embrace fitness. What are you seeing?
Well, how they did this announcement, Miss America organization, they had a tweet as a little GIF, and it had a white bikini, and then that white bikini blew up, and the message was, we're changing out of our swimsuits and into a whole new era. Hashtag bye-bye bikini. Some people online were using bye-bye bikini to say, well, bye-bye ratings for Miss America, and others were saying, it is about time that we judge women not on their looks, but on the content of their heads.
Yeah. Okay, go look for Bye Bye Bikini. Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, who helps us look at how news filters through social media every week. Femi, thank you as always.
You're welcome.
The news of Anthony Bourdain's death by suicide came just days after the news of Kate Spade's. Their deaths have renewed a conversation about how to tell if someone might be experiencing suicidal thoughts and what can be done to prevent their deaths, if anything. Joining us now is Dr. Drew Ramsey, an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Columbia University. Dr. Ramsey, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And of course, we're having this conversation today because of these two very high-profile suicides. I know that you can't comment on Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade in particular, because you are not their psychiatrist. But some of the grief that people are expressing today is, you know, these people seem to have it all. They seem to be so happy. Is that a misconception about people who end up ending their life by themselves?
That's a massive misperception, as we know. And I think it's very surprising to us when we see individuals who we think have great mental health, dream jobs, kids, fame. And that's not what's going on for the inside, on the inside of them. And so that we shouldn't have any misperceptions about depression or about suicide. These are tenacious illnesses, and they influence everyone from every socioeconomic class. It is not a disease that discriminates at all.
Are there warning signs that people should be looking out for to know when someone needs help?
Yes, certainly. And one concern I have as a clinician is that when we see suicides like this, we think there's nothing we can do. And that is not the case. We know that there are significant risk factors that are very clear for suicide. Risk factors are having a prior suicide attempt, having a mood disorder like depression, having a substance abuse or alcohol abuse disorder. Those are the top risk factors.
What would you tell our listeners today, you know, if they are deeply affected by hearing the news of Anthony Bourdain's suicide, is there anything you can say to help people better understand what happened?
Well, a number of things. The first is I would suggest that people know that we don't know what's going on inside of someone. And it's our job to be curious to those we know and we love and get a conversation going about this. Another tip that is very important is to use the word suicide and to talk about what we feel are very difficult questions, and they are, although, you know, I ask them every day in my practice, right. But it sounds hard to say, are you having thoughts about wanting to kill yourself? Any thoughts at all? And to really pursue it as an almost neutral topic. What are those thoughts? When did they start? Are you making some plans? Those frank, honest conversations about how someone is feeling is not what happens. Oftentimes, we hear someone is depressed or feeling sad or suicidal, and we say, oh, you shouldn't feel that way. That's not helpful, because people are feeling that way. And it's our job to be with the people we love in their feeling state and try and understand it with them. I think the other part to really emphasize is there's everything from the National Suicide Hotline, 800-273-TALK. There are suicide text lines. And in every state in America, there are a bevy of wonderful mental health clinicians, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, clergy, who are ready, willing, and able, and trained to talk about this. Mm-hmm. And so we want to talk about it, but we also want to be very vigilant right now. If you are an individual who loved Anthony Bourdain or Kate Spade and you're really struggling with clinical depression and you've been suicidal, there's that temptation almost, or that door opening of someone that you look up to has died by suicide. And that is like having chest pain. You should go right to the emergency room, because It is a medical emergency when an individual is feeling significantly suicidal, and we don't treat our mental health with the same diligence and the same sense of emergency that we do our physical health, mm-hmm. and we have to change that.
That's Dr. Drew Ramsey, Assistant Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at Columbia University. Dr. Ramsey, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, to Salt Lake City, Utah now, where late last Saturday night, 21-year-old Terrence Mannery was working at the Doki Doki Dessert Shop, we're told it means heartbeat in Japanese, when four distraught men ran in and told Terrence they'd just left the Utah Pride Festival and were being pursued by a mob. Sure enough, soon 15 to 20 men yelling anti-gay slurs tried to crowd into first the outside door and then the tiny vestibule and then through the door to the cafe, when, to the astonishment of customers and staff, Terrence Mannery ran and placed himself between that door and the men to try to fend them off. He was shoved hard enough to break the door hinge, punched as many as seven times. Eventually, a neighboring security guard came. The mob fled, but he'd held them off. And Terrence joins us now by Skype from Salt Lake City. Terrence, lots of punches. You okay?
Yeah, at this point, I'm fully healed up. It was just a few minor scars, a little bit of a bloody nose, but nothing too major, though.
Okay, well, but a major move that you made. People have been so thankful. What did you think when you first saw this unfolding, a mob?
I was surprised because I thought, like, as a community, we were moving forward. When I first came out to Utah a few years ago, I went to Pride. I saw a couple signs out there, but I didn't hear about anything violent going on. And it just seemed like in the past few years that everyone was becoming more accepting and everyone was coming together more. So this really surprised me that we had people out there that Saturday night who were taking actions like that.
Well, you just mentioned you're a member of this community, the gay community. You are gay. You're also African-American. And this was an all-white crowd. Did you ever hesitate on either front, being black and gay, and they're yelling anti-gay slurs?
So with the fact that I'm bisexual and black, generally most people who would have a problem with either of those things, they tend to notice the black part first. During my time out here in Utah, I've had a few incidents and run-ins with a couple people who haven't been too excited to see me due to my skin color, but at this point in my life, since I've dealt with it so many times, it didn't even cross my mind twice. My main thought was to protect everyone inside the store, protect the customers, and make sure no one got hurt.
Well, and you did, and the customers inside could not help you. The staff that included, we understand, your partner, couldn't help you because there was a pile of chairs piled on top of each other in the vestibule but that got knocked over, and so it blocked the door. They couldn't even get out to help you.
There was no way that anyone from inside the store was getting out, and nor did I want anyone inside the store getting out. Both my partner and my boss, they're under 5'5", and weigh barely 100 pounds soaking wet. I didn't want them getting out there at all. Like, my main thing was making sure everyone stayed safe. So for me, the chairs falling over actually was a good thing because since no one could get out, that also meant no one could get in and do any harm as well.
Yeah. Well, and you were standing between them both. Did you look in people's eyes? Did you look? Some people describe them as, you know, blue-eyed, blonde, all-American-looking Utah boys. Did you find yourself, like, what did you see in their eyes?
So at least for the gentleman that I came face to face with before the fighting had started, he definitely had hate in his eyes. I felt like if I were to, like, let them pass into the store, if I were to, like, not go out and confront them, that the situation would have escalated a lot more and it could have became way more deadly and dangerous. And that's not something that I wanted.
No, I guess not. Terrence, do you not worry that you're going to be a target, though?
I'm not necessarily worried about it, but I'm pretty sure at this point I should be. My boss and my partner, they've both expressed that I should be a little bit on alert, but I don't know. So far, all the responses I've received have been supportive.
Yeah, and I have to say that if anybody if you do become a target, you have a whole bunch of new friends. Look, we know the police are asking for the public's help in identifying these men who are involved. The Utah Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce is offering $5,000 for information leading to arrests. There haven't been any at this point. But meanwhile, what's happened to you since Saturday night? You went back to work, and what started happening?
So at least that Saturday night, I just thought that after the situation calmed down, that I could just go back to work, finished up the last few orders. And like all of the customers were, they were more worried about like if I was okay and I was just trying to go back to my job. But the following days after that, I've just been receiving so many thanks from everyone across the spectrum. And it's just been really overwhelming for me. I'm not really used to being like the center of attention, but I'm loving it. I'm glad that I can inspire hope in others as well to stand up, and just really glad that everyone's safe.
Talk more about that. Inspire others to stand up.
So we have moved forward as a community, but there's so much more that we can do. And I know a lot of people don't feel like they can stand up for themselves, but like, I just want to remind people that they can. Obviously, there are safer ways to do it than I did. But even if you're just an ally, you can still say something to the guys who are making a joke about your friend or even the kid you don't know. Like, there's always something you can do. And if you're just going to stand by and let these type of things happen, to me, you're just as bad as the people who are promoting the hate.
What would you want to say to those 15 to 20 men?
First, I just want to say that I'm sorry that they have that mindset. I truly do feel sorry for them, because to have that type of thought process in your brain to where you're thinking, oh, I don't agree with that person's lifestyle, let me go attack and harass them. The fact that that's what comes to their mind is truly saddening to me, and I feel like they need some type of help.
That's 21-year-old Terrence Mannery, who protected four gay men who are being attacked by an angry mob in Salt Lake City. Terrence Mannery, thank you so much.
Oh yeah, thank you.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Trump administration is still trying to hack away at the Affordable Care Act. The Justice Department filed a brief yesterday that essentially sides with a lawsuit claiming the Obama-era law is unconstitutional. Now, a coalition of 20 states is suing the federal government, saying the ACA is invalid now that Congress has repealed the penalty for not having health insurance, that individual mandate requirement. The Justice Department says it agrees with those conservative-leaning states, and it will not defend several other key provisions of the law, including the one that requires insurance companies cover people with pre-existing conditions. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us. And Mike, we know in 2012, the Supreme Court said the ACA's individual mandate, the requirement, was constitutional because Congress has the power to impose taxes, so the penalty was seen as a tax. Then last year, Congress repealed the penalty or tax for not having insurance. So how did that play into the case? Is that at the heart of this?
Well, yeah, it is. And it's a little complicated, but it's important to note that what the Trump Justice Department is doing is arguing that the Obamacare provisions that require insurers to cover pre-existing medical conditions, the Justice Department is now arguing that they are sort of one in the same with the individual mandate that requires all Americans to have health insurance or else pay a penalty. So you're right. The Supreme Court in 2012 had upheld the individual mandate because it ruled that it fell under the government's authority to issue taxes. But since last year, Congress actually repealed the tax element of it. The Trump Justice Department is now arguing that there is no justification for the individual mandate because there's no tax associated with it. And that requirement is basically inseparable from the rules requiring insurers to cover pre-existing conditions. So both of those elements of Obamacare are at issue here.
When you say that it's inseparable, do you mean because you can't really cover pre-existing conditions unless you require everybody by insurance? Is that what you mean?
Well,
or is it just because it's a requirement?
The Trump Justice Department is basically fusing the two issues and saying you can't separate them. If you do want an insurance company to cover pre-existing conditions, part of the thinking of the individual mandate was that younger, healthier people who might not necessarily think they even need health insurance would actually be required to buy it. So that gives insurance companies very low-risk customers to sort of bring down the costs for those higher-risk customers with pre-existing conditions.
Well, states like New York are expecting to see premiums rise by 20% or more in 2019. And insurance companies are partially blaming the repeal of the individual mandate penalty for just the reason you said. Young, healthy people without a requirement to take it won't.
Right. Right. Yeah. And in New York State, it's a very eye-popping increase that the Department of Financial Services is projecting. About 12% if the individual mandate survives. But if it's repealed, they're saying about 24%. Now, this is for individuals buying insurance from the state marketplace that was created under Obamacare. So it's for that group of people it's important to point out, not for the entire population.
Look, we're going to give this a lot more time down the road. Michael Regan, senior editor of Bloomberg News, on more disruption of health insurance. Mike, thanks.
Thank you, Robin.
Anti-establishment political parties are gaining a foothold in Europe after recent elections in countries including Italy, Hungary, and Slovenia. Many of those movements are right-wing and anti-immigration, but candidates opposing European Union policies are finding success across the political spectrum. Jonathan Polk is an associate professor of political science at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. Professor, welcome.
Thanks.
And I want to talk about what's going on in a few specific countries in a moment, but first, just the big picture. Former White House advisor Steve Bannon said this week that French President Emmanuel Macron's vision of a more integrated Europe is dead, that Italy and Hungary killed it. What do you think of that statement? Is he right?
Well, I think it's difficult to say whether something is as strong as that is correct. But I think it's certainly accurate to suggest that the European Union is under a type of strain that it's not it hasn't seen in several years, and that the elections in Hungary and Italy, to a large extent, do challenge the EU in fundamental ways.
Well, let's talk about Italy. This week, the parliament there voted on a new coalition government. Giuseppe Conte, a lawyer with no previous political experience, was chosen to head a coalition of the far-right League and the anti-establishment Five Star Movement. What do you think the elections in Italy, the results there, say about the future of the EU?
Well, I think the elections in Italy definitely challenge the hope for someone like Macron that there had been a more mainstream center-left or center-right government that he could work with to push reforms in the Eurozone and other areas of cooperation. Both the League and, to some extent, the Five Star Movement have been more Euroskeptical in their positions, and some of the League have been outright resistant to the idea of further cooperation on the euro in particular. So it's certainly going to be a challenge for the EU moving forward.
Well, and in the case of those two parties, one is on the right and one is on the left. I mean, what does that tell you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of a challenge to place the Five Star Party more so than the League, but it's certainly not right wing, and I'd say it's centrist, if not center left, in terms of their voter profiles, and at least to some degree, it's a reflection of the common anti-establishment kind of anti-elite perspective that both of these parties share, and it's a reflection that they have something in common on that front. If not necessarily as it relates to their economic policy positions.
Is what they have in common just populism?
I think that's certainly one aspect of what they have in common. But I think it's also an anti-establishment type of a feeling, which is one component of populism. But I'm not sure if that in and of itself is enough to refer to both as pure populists.
What about what's going on in Hungary, where right-wing populism is on the rise? Prime Minister Viktor Orban recently won re-election on an anti-immigration platform. In that case, is it about immigration? Is it about resentment of all of the people coming in?
Well, Hungary has actually taken in rather few overall quotas, refugee quotas, right, and are resistant to that idea of the European Union. But they certainly were for a long time during the refugee crisis of 2015 and 2016, a major kind of port of entry, and had a lot of migrants attempting to flow through before they closed their borders. And so I think anti-immigration sentiment is certainly a big part of Orbán's most recent win there, as is to some degree not anti-EU in the sense that anybody wants to leave the EU. I don't think Hungarians are mobilizing to exit the European Union, but they certainly have a vision for what the European Union is that is, in a lot of situations, radically different than what a lot of the Western European former and original member states might have conceived of what the EU was all about.
Well, is that part of the problem, that Western Europe kind of came up with the theory of what the EU should be, and then they started letting a lot of Eastern European countries in that don't have the same vision?
I think there was potentially at least a little bit of optimism and maybe even naivete as it relates to the likelihood with which the Central and Eastern European countries, after the fall of communism, would ultimately start to converge on the more liberal democratic forms of democracy that are practiced in Western Europe. And there was a kind of expectation that that was almost an inevitability. And what we're seeing to some extent within Hungary and Poland as well, and some of the other V4 countries, is a maturation of a different vision of what democracy might look like in that region.
Well, and we also should bring up Slovenia. They just had an election there, mm-hmm. which is sort of inconclusive, but an anti-immigrant party also did pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. It's certainly a trend across Europe, both East and West.
What about Spain? There was a sudden shift in government last week. Former Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy received a no-confidence vote from Parliament and was ousted from power. But unlike some of the countries we've been talking about, it wasn't because of a political surge from the far right. Mm-hmm. What happened in Spain?
Well, my understanding of the Spanish situation is it's a really important to differentiate it from the Italian. It's a pretty different situation. And as I understand it, it's much more based on corruption and a corruption scandal that relates to the former prime minister's major party and to some extent touches on him as well. And so this was more a response to specific aspects of the Spanish party system than it is any part of this kind of broader systemic anti-establishment, anti-elite type of populist movements.
Is the cloud hanging over all of this, all of these countries we've been talking about, the fact that the UK is about to leave the EU? If not, you know, a member that was fully in, it was sort of a pillar of stability.
That certainly isn't making things easier, and it definitely destabilized politics across the continent in a way that is important to grapple with and has real ramifications. But I'm not certain that we wouldn't be finding similar kinds of stories here, even if the UK were still to be around. I think the pressures that were brought on by the immigration surge after the civil war in Syria, those would have brought about a lot of difficulties no matter what. And then other aspects of the Eurozone, the kind of imbalance between the lack of coordination between fiscal and monetary policy, that's not specific to the UK either. So I think while it's certainly important to keep in mind that something like Brexit is an extremely important shock for the whole political system, it's not the only pressure. And I think there's a good case to be made that it would still be in a difficult position even without Brexit.
So who is in a position to save the EU? It's obviously not Angela Merkel anymore because she just barely hung on to power in Germany. Is it Emmanuel Macron?
I don't know if it's a single actor. I suspect that to some degree it's a matter of Macron finding partners that he can work with that will also at the same time potentially even temper some of his ambitions. I think some type of more multifaceted, multi-speed, more or less somewhat a la carte aspect of the European Union is probably in the future for the EU. I think it's increasingly becoming a case where mainstream parties are going to need to make a positive case for the European Union if they want their electorates to support it. And so it's going to be less about trying to minimize it, trying to bring it away from the front pages of newspapers, and more about trying to actively make the case as to what the European Union can do for the citizens of Europe.
Do you think if we had this conversation in 5 years that all of the members of the EU minus Britain would still be in?
If you had asked me that question 5 years ago, I would have answered in a much different way than I do now. And now I think there's certainly a way in which there's more of a utilitarian and pragmatic calculus that goes into a country's membership within the European Union. And I guess for people that are pro-EU, that have a lot of optimism and hope for the European project as such, the thing I think they should be most concerned about is another shock. I think it's difficult to keep in mind during the kind of the context of our current conversation here that over the last 2 to 3 years, I guess maybe more two than three, things have actually been going rather well for Europe in a macroeconomic sense of the word, right? There's been growth, unemployment's coming down. Things are pretty good here, and we're still having conversations like the one we are right now. If there were another large exogenous financial shock or something along those lines around like what we saw in 2008 or 2009, I think a lot of things would be plausible that might not seem likely at the moment. So I certainly wouldn't think it's an impossibility that 5 years from now, another member state might have voted to leave. Although at the same time, I don't see that in the polling at the moment, right? There's no member state now where there's any kind of anywhere close to the numbers supporting leaving like there was in the United Kingdom.
That's Jonathan Polk, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. He's also at the Center for European Research. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
That's Mine, the opening track on Dove, the first album in 23 years by the alternative rock band Belly. The indie group shot up the charts in 93, was in heavy rotation on radio and MTV, remember that? Now Belly is back on a tour of the U.S. and the U.K. with their new songs. Andrea Shea from member station WBUR visited the band at their Rhode Island rehearsal space and has this story.
Singer and guitarist Tanya Donnelly will never forget the moment Belly's debut album, Star, reached number 2 on the UK albums chart.
Sir Paul McCartney actually wrote us a note because he came in at 3.
In the US, college radio DJs gave the album's single, Feed the Tree, a lot of airtime. The exposure helped land Belly gigs on network television, including an appearance on Late Night with David Letterman.
Our next guests are a great band. I've just been told that this is the number one college band in the country. Is that right? Bigger even than the Ohio State band?
Feed the Tree is one of the songs on a whiteboard set list in the basement of bass player Gail Greenwood's Rhode Island home. The space where Belly rehearsed back in the day is still affectionately called the Rock and Roll Control Center. On a recent afternoon, the band's four musicians played a pared-down version of their old hit.
Take your hat off when you're talking to me and be there when I...
Drummer Chris Gorman remembers the explosion of energy around this tune in the early 90s, with sold-out shows, big venues, lines of fans around the block. He says a slew of indie bands were rising at the time.
And they were all gathering steam. It wasn't just like us and with a weird little spike. It was like a whole sort of wave of music was kind of happening.
Belly went on to play with the Cranberries, Radiohead, Oasis. The soundtrack of the 90s was fueled by the post-Nirvana record label craze to sign the next big indie band.
Anything that had slightly grungy guitars with a melody on top of it was considered indie rock.
Tabitha Soren was a reporter for MTV at the time.
Courtney Love and Hole, people like Liz Phair, and Tanya Donnelly and Belly fit right into that. She was ripe for MTV.
Belly went on to open for U2, but the band only lasted about 2 years. Belly broke up in 95 after their second album, King, didn't meet record label sales expectations.
You breathe.
These days, the musicians would rather talk about their reunion than their breakup. The four have stayed in touch over the years. Some have been raising kids, all pursued solo projects. In 2016, they decided it was time to tour again. Fans responded to their four new songs, and Belly was able to crowdsource the new album, Dove.
I see the truth break over your face like a bad egg.
Record company Independence has been liberating for guitarist Tom Gorman, the drummer's brother. He wove the album's pieces together, preferring a more polished sound over the deliberately lo-fi production style dominant in the 90s.
Of course, there's going to be a handful of people that are like, it's not edgy enough or whatever, but you can do anything you want.
You keep my key and my lazy letters. I keep the angel that you bought to watch over me. I know you thought.
The musicians collaborated on crafting the album. Donnelly points to the single Shiny One.
Gail brought the chorus, and then Tom added chords, and then I wrote the verse parts over, and we kind of stitched that together, and then Chris's drums really informed where that song went.
Was sort of like a rail against patronizing.
Yeah, and I heard it as
enough,
sort of
dude.
This
mansplaining.
Yeah, and it turned into sort of the duality that comes with that.
Angel.
You know, the fallen angel
yep.
and the
mm-hmm.
and the
mm-hmm.
our
don't
better,
forget where you come from.
Yes,
son.
Our better angels are fallen angels, and where we fall between the two.
The reunited rockers are on tour with their new songs for the next 6 months or so. Then they'll figure out what's next. For now, they're happy to be a scrappy DIY operation while they fit making music together again into their busy lives. For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Shea.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.